Welcome to Sharper Iron. Spend the next hour with us studying the living and active Word of God, His two-edged sword of law and gospel, recorded for you in Holy Scripture, all about Jesus Christ, crucified, risen, and descended for you. Thanks for tuning in this morning here on KFUO, Christ for you, anytime, anywhere. I am your host, Pastor Timothy Apple of Faith Lutheran Church in Godfrey, Illinois. Sharper Iron is underwritten by Lutheran Church Extension Fund. Together in Faith, LCEF helps to start, sustain, and strengthen LCMS ministries through financial and strategic partnerships. Visit lcef.org for more information. On this Tuesday, October 14th, we are studying Song of Solomon, chapter 6, verse 11 through chapter 8, verse 4. In today's text, the bride and the bridegroom rejoice in their married love. To help us sharpen our faith in Christ as we study God's Word today, we have with us regular guest, Pastor David Vandercook. Pastor Vandercook serves at Bethlehem Evangelical Lutheran Church in Crawford, Nebraska, and Redeemer Evangelical Lutheran Church in Harrison, Nebraska. Pastor Vandercook, welcome back to Sharper Iron.
Good to be with you again.
As we get started today, Pastor Vandercook, talk to us a little bit about the Song of Solomon. There's not a narrative per se, but there are a few things that happen. What do we need to know about the text? What's happening as we prepare to look at this section?
Well, the Song of Solomon is kind of it's got these repeating cycles. This is the sixth such cycle. The first half of the Song of Solomon focused kind of on dating and courtship, really, of Solomon and his bride. And the second half of Song of Solomon has this ongoing era of married love that occurs after their marriage. And so the cycle is the same roughly throughout, the cycle that repeats itself. But we can also point to that when we look at those who are married, that even, before marriage, those who are married, they anticipate the married love that they will enjoy. And then once they're married, they still rejoice in that. And of course, the greater thing that's looming in the background throughout the book is the portrayal of the relationship between Christ and his church.
Yeah, we've talked about both of those aspects of the book throughout. In the previous section, the fifth cycle that we looked at last time, there was a little bit of conflict within the love. We saw the husband coming and the bride not answering right away, and a need to call back. Some reconciliation and joy has happened in the previous cycle, and that joy for the marriage continues into this section. Again, we have the two speakers, the she and the he, as well as some others that are in the mix. I think you mentioned to me, Pastor Vandercook, before we started, that Dr. Mitchell in his commentary maybe disagrees occasionally with the way the ESV breaks that up, and it's rather early on in the text.
Yes, at the end of chapter 6, you have one of these sections that's marked as others, and then, it splits verse 13. Others are mentioned there for the first half of the verse, and then the second half of the verse, the ESV has the note that it's he is in Solomon. And Dr. Mitchell, in his commentary, includes the entirety of verse 13 as being others, and then he, that is Solomon, picking up at the beginning of chapter 7. We can talk about that more perhaps as we read the text itself.
Okay, let's go ahead and read the text then. I've been breaking it up kind of as the speakers begin and end, so I'm just going to read first what she says in verses 11 and 12 of chapter 6. I went down to the nut orchard to look at the blossoms of the valley, to see whether the vines had budded, whether the pomegranates were in bloom. Before I was aware, my desire set me among the chariots of my kinsmen, a prince. And so that's verses 11 and 12 of chapter 6, words from the bride to the bridegroom. What's she saying here?
Yeah, well, she's looking for her husband here. And whenever we have these, the text here calls it a nut orchard. You could also look at it as a type of garden. And, you can make comparisons to other gardens that we have in the Bible, such as the Garden of Eden, or, perhaps even better would be thinking about the garden outside the tomb where Jesus was laid and then raised. And so you have the women who go searching for Jesus in the garden, for example, that they come searching for him, and then they do actually suddenly find him. And here, in this case, the finding actually happens as she's kind of suddenly swept away by her prince here, it says, in the chariots of her kinsmen. Yeah. Mm.
We've seen this looking before. In the previous section, there was a looking that happened, and he wasn't found right away. And again, there was a reconciliation, a forgiveness that the husband bestowed upon the wife. Back in chapter 3, in the matter of more of a courtship, there was, again, a seeking and a finding that was very, very reminiscent of what happened in John 20, especially with Mary Magdalene looking for Jesus. And so here again, we have that, you know, matter of seeking after the husband, the nut orchard, and lots of other garden imagery in here. So as we think about this in terms of like married love between a husband and a wife, I guess we're seeing a picture of that continued desire for the husband here in this case.
Right. Yeah. Well, and additionally, when you have the chariots of my kinsmen there, this also is similar imagery that we find, you know, for example, when Elijah is carried up into heaven and Elisha is looking up for him, longing for him. And the same also with the disciples when Jesus ascends into heaven, that they also long for him to return. And so to them, it's not good, of course, that they're without that person, but being in the chariots, of course, really is the best thing in the case of Elijah and also for Jesus, of course. And so, yeah, I mean, there's all kinds of biblical imagery elsewhere that comes to bear in these couple verses. Yeah. But yeah, there is no delay here. Her desire is there, and then, you know, before she even knows what's happening, all of a sudden the chariots of her kinsmen come and capture her.
So thinking about Christ and the church, how might we see Christ and the church in this section?
Yeah, well, you know, whenever you have Christ in the church, you know, the church longs to be united with Christ, and he doesn't delay. Just in fact, this past week, you know, I highlighted the you know, like in the divine service when we have the Kyrie, Lord have mercy upon us, Christ have mercy upon us, Lord have mercy upon us. The answer to the Kyrie comes immediately in the liturgy with the Gloria in Excelsis that follows on its heels, where immediately there is Jesus, the one who comes to bring mercy. And so that's there as well. You know, the idea that there is no delay. Whenever Christ's people call for him, whenever his church calls for him, Christ does not delay his coming.
Mm. Yeah. Is it Isaiah that has before they call to me, I answered them, is a promise from the Lord? I think that's in Isaiah. But the same idea, like you're saying, this is the Lord answers our prayers. He delights to hear us and to be there as we seek after him. Seek the Lord while he may be found. That's his promise, not because he's lost, as we've said other times, but because he wants to be your God. And so he is here for his church, expressed here in the words of the bride, as she is named in the next verse, the Shulamite. We've been referring to her. We've talked about the fact that she is a Shulamite, and this is where it actually gets mentioned in the book for the first time here in 6:13. So I'm going to read all of 6:13, Pastor Vandercook, and then, as you noted, the ESV divides this into others, and then the bridegroom. We'll talk about maybe who's talking here in all of verse 13.
Yeah, just one real quick note again about, I was just thinking about this with verse 12. Well, verses 11 and 12, the seeking of the bridegroom here, and the fact that, you know, as I said earlier, the second half of the book is really after there is this marriage relationship that's been established. Because somebody might say, oh, well, you know, obviously all analogies are going to fail at some point. That's usually the way it goes. But whenever we talk about the seeking of the bridegroom, you know, because there are, we can read elsewhere in, you know, in Paul's letters that nobody seeks Christ, you know, but here we're dealing with one who is already already in this marriage relationship, as in already in the church. And so once we're already in the church, yes, of course we seek Christ. You know, it's like the hymn, Jesus Priceless Treasure, which I think one of the stanzas in there has the line, Jesus is my choice. You know, the unregenerate cannot sing that, but those who have been brought into Christ's kingdom, those who have been united with Christ, yeah, we can make that choice because we've already been sanctified and been made part of his church. And here the same is true as well. The bride seeks the husband because she's already, or the, you know, the wife seeks the husband because she's already in that relationship with him. Anyway, yes, I just thought I'd throw that in there. It just popped into my head. So
no, that's helpful. That's helpful. Yeah, this is talking about those who have been made Christians and the joy of the church to seek after Jesus continually is present within this section. In verse 13, then we find out she is the Shulamite. Here's the text of 6:13. Return, return, O Shulamite. Return, return, that we may look upon you. Why should you look upon the Shulamite as upon a dance before two armies? Again, that's 6:13. The ESV suggests that the first half is others, and the second half of that verse begins the speech of the bridegroom. You said Dr. Mitchell thinks this is all the others, maybe the daughters of Jerusalem, the chorus of sorts that we've had. What are the details there as to who's speaking?
Yeah, it seems like there's a few different possibilities there. You know, first of all, you know, I note that, you know, the study notes in the Lutheran Study Bible seem to suggest that the others in this case is not necessarily even the daughters of Jerusalem, but rather that it is the kind of Solomon's entourage, you know, that's with Solomon there at his chariots, you know. But if we look at others in the rest of the book, it seems that others is more dealing with the daughters of Jerusalem, perhaps even, you know, Solomon's got lots of wives and concubines and so forth, and it could be referring to all of them. And then, you know, the ESV has the break there in the middle of verse 13 where it switches to he, that is Solomon, being the speaker. But the way that Dr. Mitchell proposes this is that the second half of the verse 13 is kind of an antiphonal response with the daughters of Jerusalem, also a different group of the daughters of Jerusalem, I suppose, giving that response in the second half of the verse. And it's sort of a rhetorical question then that comes at the second half of the verse. So yeah, there's a couple different possibilities in how we look at this. You know, notable about verse 13 here is that if you compare this to, say, earlier in the book, like Song of Solomon chapter 1, verses 5 and 6, you have the Shulamite basically not wanting to be gazed upon by anybody else because she feels like she's not worthy to be gazed upon, doesn't feel like she's very beautiful. She's dark because she's been working out in the vineyard, you know, which, I mean, again, shows kind of a difference in perhaps a difference in culture, I guess, at the time and so forth, whereas darkened skin in some places is looked upon as a positive quality. There it was looked up, at that point in time, looked upon as a negative type of thing because that indicated you had been working outside quite a bit, you know. Mm-hmm. But anyway, yeah, there's a couple different ways to look at this verse, yeah.
So, well, let's focus on the, you know, she did not want to be gazed upon in chapter 1, and here there is the, like, maybe there is this desire to look upon her. We talked a little bit about this in chapter 1, that although she does not see herself as one to be looked upon in any sort of beauty, the husband does, and I think we're going to encounter something, regardless of what she thinks at this point, we're certainly about to see how the husband looks upon her. Yeah. And we think about the way that, you know, again, Christ loves his church, that he is the one who cleanses her and presents her to himself without spot or wrinkle or blemish. And maybe we're getting another picture of that here within the context of the marriage.
Yeah, well, and of course, before the marriage, there is this thing where the only one that sees her as beautiful is the husband. And now that she has been this way, now she is in a constant state of being beautiful, you know, because she has been redeemed by the bridegroom in this case. Yeah. So yeah, absolutely. You know that there is a difference there again with first half of the book being courtship and then the second half being within the confines of marriage. Yeah.
So as I mentioned before, here is the place in the book that we hear that the bride is the Shulamite. And we've talked a little bit about this in other contexts as to what that might indicate about who she is. The Lutheran Study Bible suggests that this may be a reference to the reality that she is Abishag, the Shunammite. Any thoughts on the title, the Shulamite, that comes up here?
Yeah, a couple things. Some other possibilities here. Yeah, the Shulamite, yeah, first of all, it could be Abishag, the Shumanite, our Shunammite, who was the one that comforted David in his old age. Although, you know, the text in 2 Samuel, is that 2 Samuel? Yeah, 2 Samuel toward the end there indicates that, you know, makes it very clear that David did not lie with this woman, that he did not have sexual relations with her. So she was not his wife or his concubine, however you want to say that. And in fact, one of David's sons, I can't remember which one, it was not Solomon, but one of his other sons wanted to take her as his wife upon David's death, and it was not permitted of him. And so the idea there is perhaps that taking her as a wife would be seen as claiming the throne. And so if that's seen as claiming the throne, it's quite possible that Solomon would have actually taken her as his wife. And that would not have been a violation of God's law at that point in time, because God's law did not, you know, would not have forbidden this woman who was not previously married, had not been married to his father, to be married to Solomon. So that's very possible. It is also possible, as suggested in that same note in the study Bible, that this is the feminine noun that's formed from the name Solomon, just indicating their relationship as husband and wife. But, you know, at any rate, yeah, a couple different possibilities there as well for who this Shulamite is. What we do know is this is Solomon's wife. We're right. Just not sure in what sense it is or exactly who it is.
Right, right. Okay, so that's where we get the title from. Anything else in verse 13 from these words from the others before we move into the speech of the bridegroom?
Yeah, no, I think we can move on after that, okay. Yeah.
All right, so we're picking up now with chapter 7 of Song of Solomon. In the first verse, there's an extended speech from the bridegroom here in which he extols the beauty of his bride. So Song of Solomon 7, verse 1 and following. How beautiful are your feet in sandals, O noble daughter! Your rounded thighs are like jewels, the work of a master hand. Your navel is a rounded bowl that never lacks mixed wine. Your belly is a heap of wheat encircled with lilies. Your breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle. Your neck is like an ivory tower. Your eyes are pools in Heshbon by the gate of Beth Rabim. Your nose is like a tower of Lebanon, which looks toward Damascus. Your head crowns you like Carmel, and your flowing locks are like purple. A king is held captive in the tresses. How beautiful and pleasant you are, O loved one, with all your delights. Your stature is like a palm tree, and your breasts are like its clusters. I say I will climb the palm tree and lay hold of its fruit. O may your breasts be like clusters of the vine, and the scent of your breath like apples, and your mouth like the best wine. I'll pause there. That brings us to the next place where the bride will speak. So that's 7:1 through 9a. So here we have another section in which the bridegroom extols the beauty of his bride using images that perhaps are a little unusual to us today, but a lot of things to talk about here. Take us into the first verse. We're starting with her feet in the sandals.
Yeah, just overall, the whole section is just kind of this very, very descriptive. And sometimes, I think this is one of the, whenever you come upon these sections in Song of Solomon, I think it's, and maybe this is just a condemnation of our own depravity, is that we see these and it's kind of it almost makes us a little uncomfortable sometimes as we read it. But you know, it is a beautiful description that we have of the bride here, and shows, you know, just how the bridegroom views his bride, as we've said before, that, you know, and he just desires to be with her just so much in this whole thing, and wants to extol her beauty.
Well,
you know,
to that point, Pastor Vanderkirk, before we look at some of the things that he says, I've mentioned this, or this has been mentioned in chatting with the guests off air, but I think it's worth pointing out that it does seem that in our world today, in our culture today, there's two extremes when it comes to this. There's either just a shame over talking about these things, the gift of married love between a husband and a wife. There's a shame that doesn't want to talk about them or tries to use all kinds of euphemisms for them. That's one extreme. And then the other extreme is to just be entirely crass and vulgar about these things and use language that no one should use in speaking about them. And it almost seems like there's I don't this very frank and upfront. This is the gift that God has given a husband and a wife, and there's great joy to be found in the love between a husband and a wife in the marriage bed. We don't have that sort of middle ground in our world today, and we come across Song of Solomon, we're not sure what to do with a section like this.
Yeah, you're right. I think that's very true. And I think this will come to bear at the very end of this, toward the end of this section that we're covering today too, but there is kind of this, you know, perhaps the middle ground in all of this is that this section could almost read as crass to some, I suppose, but you do have to keep it in context here that we are talking about the relationship between a husband and a wife. Yeah. And some of these descriptors are not things that perhaps you would out in the open declare to somebody, you know, to your wife. You would do this privately to one that you're married to, you know. Does that make sense? It's like extolling the beauty of my wife. It's not something that I'm necessarily going to just use flowing language like this in front of the rest of the world. And I don't think that's the setting here. You know, this is Solomon, his private discussion that he's having with the Shulamite. And of course we're able to read it because now it's put into words for us, it's written down for us, and it's presented to us. But in its initial context, this was a private conversation between, you know, Solomon and the Shulamite here.
I think that's right, that we should keep it in that context of the conversation between a husband and a wife. We talked about this in a previous section, how there are times where as you read the text, there's maybe a temptation to try to read more into the images than is there, and to think, well, what's he really talking about? And that's not a good thing to do, because part of that is the intimacy between a husband and a wife, where they are able to use language that is known to the two of them, that within the bond of marriage strengthens their love for each other. But for an outsider to read more than they should, or try to read details into it that they think are there, is maybe a misuse of that text. So I do think that to understand this within the conversation between the two of them, I think is very appropriate, and helps us then as we read it to appreciate it for what it is in its frankness and directness, that it's not trying to be bawdy or anything like that, but this is a husband and a wife who are able to entirely rejoice in the gift that God has given them in each other.
Right, yeah. And I suppose, whenever you turn this then, and, you know, obviously we've talked about this, about how we have kind of two things happening here with the expression of love between a husband and a wife, and then you also, of course, this mirrors the love between Christ and his church. You know, the same thing is probably true when it comes to the church. Christians address, where God addresses Christians different than he addresses unbelievers. And sometimes the things that, you know, you talk about, you know, maybe this is too big of a leap, but to have the conversation about things like the most intimate connection that we have with our God is at the communion rail with that relationship, and that is reserved for those who have that relationship with the bridegroom, not for the rest of the world. You know, so there's those similar types of things. I don't know if that's a good jump or not to make at this point in time, but that's something that just came to my mind as well. You know, making that comparison to the relationship of Christ and the church as well.
Sure, I think it's a fair way to see what happens in the way that a person would maybe be brought into the church. Anything, think about the way the catechism is arranged, that the sacraments do come after, you know, as we've learned what God expects of us in the commandments and who he is in the creed and how we speak to him in prayer, and then the sacraments come after that as the way that God incorporates us into that relationship with him. And I mean, so I do think there is something there that you're right in bringing out, that certainly in the sacrament, that is something that you don't really get. Unless you know who Christ is, it's not the first thing that comes. And there is something to that. You have to know who he is. You have to know that he is the bridegroom and you are part of his bride, the church, to understand it. Whether or not that's in the text or not, that's maybe another question. But I think I think it fits with our conversation thus far. So
sure.
we will pick up the details of the section that we've read on the other side of the break. You're listening to Sharper Iron on KFUO. We're talking to Pastor David Vandercook this morning. We'll be right back. Please stick around.
Did you know that an investment with Lutheran Church Extension Fund exclusively supports LCMS ministries and church workers? That's right. LCEF ensures LCMS churches, schools, and organizations have access to the financial resources they need to sustain, strengthen, and start ministry work. In other words, you can feel good investing with LCEF because we share your Lutheran values and love for the church. Learn more at lcef.org. LCF is a nonprofit religious organization. Therefore, LCF investments are not FDIC insured bank deposit accounts. This is not an offer to sell investments or solicitation to buy. LCF will offer and sell its securities only in states where authorized. The offer is made solely by LCF's offering circular. Investors should carefully read the offering circular, which more fully describes associated risks.
Welcome back to Sharper Iron. It is Tuesday, October 14th. We are studying Song of Solomon, chapter 6, verse 11 through chapter 8, verse 4, with Pastor David Vandercook. He serves at Bethlehem Evangelical Lutheran Church in Crawford, Nebraska, and Redeemer Evangelical Lutheran Church in Harrison, Nebraska. Pastor Vandercook, prior to the break, had read the section on which the bridegroom speaks and praises his bride's beauty there in chapter 7. Let's start working our way through some of the details. In verse 1, we have her feet and sandals, her rounded thighs. Into verse 2, you've got her navel and her belly. Let's just jump off there, those first two.
Yeah, you know, just in general, the descriptions here of the Shulamite shows kind of just the detail of them, points out again the detail that the Creator puts into the creation of man, and specifically here, woman. You know, I think back to the creation account, in particular Genesis 2, where you have the creation of woman that's really highlighted there, where God gives Eve to Adam. And, you know, his reaction is, at last, this is bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman, for she was taken out of man. And, you know, he has that type of joy in seeing this woman who has been created specifically for him. And this almost really just builds on that same idea. Just the pleasure that Solomon takes in the fact that this is the woman that has been given to him by God, that was created specifically for him. And so he notes the Creator's effort in creating this woman for him, and just rejoices so much in her appearance and all of the details. You know, so you have, you know, in particular, I look at verses like verse 2, where we have the navel as a rounded bowl that never lacks mixed wine, and your belly as a heap of wheat encircled with lilies. You know, again, when we look at the relationship between Christ and the church, and we see the way in which Christ ultimately nourishes the church in body and in soul in the Lord's Supper, here's what I'm talking about. You know, the wine of the Lord's Supper, the wheat of the bread that is used in the Lord's Supper. You have, there's never wine that is missing. It's never lacking here. You know, you think of Jesus and the wedding at Cana in John chapter 2, with the water turned into wine, indicating that there is an abundance in the way in which God provides here, and so it's an entire heap of wheat, an unending supply. So I think, you know, that would be the first thing I look at in that description that kind of ties us into the way in which Christ provides for us in the church.
I think that's helpful. And I imagine if you read commentaries on the Song of Solomon throughout the ages, you're going to find a lot of use of verse 2 to talk about the gift of the body and blood of Jesus in the sacrament, and the way that he shows his love to his church by giving that to her. And I very much appreciate the point you made about the great detail that the Creator has given Solomon here in the bride. And the way that, you know, I mean, this is just a helpful thing, not only in terms of the marriage relationship, but as we look at God's creation, that we're always able to look at the details and give thanks to God for each and every one. You think about Luther's explanation to the first article of the Creed, or the explanation to the fourth petition of the Lord's Prayer, and those long lists that he gives you of things that God as the Creator gives to you. And you're like, wow, I never stopped and thought about all of the details. And even in that regard, Luther doesn't get as detailed as he could. I think that's a wonderful way to look at the what's going on here, that there is a joy over every single little thing that God has given, in this case, in the marriage relationship the husband has received in his wife, and a great joy that all of this, you know, this the beautiful woman that is Solomon's wife, he is able to rejoice in her as a gift from his Creator.
Yeah.
So that's just a great way of looking at this as a whole. So continuing then into the way that he describes her beauty, in verse 3, her breasts are like two fawns, her neck is like an ivory tower, eyes are pools in Heshbon, nose is like a tower in Lebanon, your head crowns you, and your flowing locks are like purple. So again, more details here. Anything particular that stands out in that section of the description?
First of all, right at the end there, the Shulamite almost certainly did not have purple hair, but you know, that's more of a modern thing, I suppose. But you know, just the comparison, you know, just she's a very stately looking woman here as well, is kind of the picture that's given here, you know, with a neck like an ivory tower. It doesn't seem like necessarily terminology that we use in the modern day to describe a beautiful woman, but nonetheless, these are very much descriptions of a beautiful woman that are given here by Solomon, because he's comparing her to things that are admired in the land, you know, so the pools at Heshbon, the gate by Beth Rabim, and the Tower of Lebanon and Damascus. These are impressive things in the world there, and he compares her favorably with them. So just further into that, yeah. And the flowing locks are like purple. That, you know, the color purple, of course, I think most of our listeners will be familiar with the idea that purple is a color for royalty, very valuable. So again, just further flowing praise for the Shulamite here.
Yeah, all of this again is the beauty that he sees in her as her husband, because this is the one for him. This is the wife that God has given to him. He beholds her in this beauty. And I think in some ways we've said, you know, he's clothed her in this beauty. You mentioned chapter 1 where she didn't want you to look at her. Her skin was dark from working in the sun. She doesn't recognize the beauty in herself or doesn't see her that way, but her husband sees her that way, and her husband clothes her that way. It was in the previous section, I think, and yeah, it was 6:10, where she's described as, "Who is this who looks down like the dawn, beautiful as the moon, bright as the sun, awesome as an army with banners?" There's John's vision in Revelation 12 begins with a woman who's clothed very much like this, with the moon, the sun, are part of the descriptors. And part of the woman there, part of the reason that the woman is so clothed is because she is reflecting the glory of the Lord. Right? You have a picture of the church, of the woman that gives birth to the child. And I think you're seeing something similar here in the way that Solomon describes the beauty of his wife. This is her beauty because, at least in part, he has clothed her with such beauty. And some of the place names that are mentioned here, I think, maybe are evidence of that. They're not all from the land of Israel, but they certainly have connections to the land of Israel or admired by the land of Israel. And I think you see the way that Solomon here is bestowing this beauty upon his bride. And again, I find that helpful when we think about especially the way Christ bestows beauty on his church.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, it's exactly that, and that's probably the great comfort here that's here for all Christians, is to look at this and see the type of beauty that Solomon is bestowing upon his wife, the type of beauty that he's attributing her with and complimenting her for. That's the way that Christ looks at us, you know, that we who may feel that we are not worthy to be gazed upon. And on top of that, you know, obviously I think there's a lesson here for husbands as well, in that the way in which we view our wife ought to reflect this, you know, because in the world, you know, husbands can often be tempted to gaze upon women that are not their wives and gaze upon their beauty. But this encourages husbands to look upon the one that God has given them and see them in this way, see them as the one that's been specifically given to them.
I think that's a very helpful reminder. We talked about that previously in the book, especially in chapter 2, where she speaks of herself as a rose of Sharon, a lily among the valley. She sees herself as, you know, kind of one flower among many flowers. And then when he speaks in the very next verse, in 2 verse 2, he sees her as a lily among brambles. So as he looks upon her, she is the only one for him.
Yeah.
And especially when you think about this then in the context of, you know, more courtship in the first part of the book, and now in married love in the second part of the book, I think that's a good way of seeing how the love between a man and a woman who are given to each other in marriage grows over the years. You know, I mean, he has not, if anything, his appreciation for her beauty, his appreciation for her as the only one for him, has only multiplied as the years have gone by rather than diminished.
Yeah, right. Yeah, the continual growing of that love, that and reignition of that love, perhaps.
Yeah.
And I think that's what you see with these continual cycles in the Song of Solomon in general. It's just kind of a return to that same type of desire that's still there even in married life. Yeah.
As this section comes to an end here of the bridegroom's speech, verses 6 to 9, he especially praises her breasts in a number of ways. This is one of those places where the language is very frank, and we're invited to rejoice then in the gift of married love, the married union between a husband and a wife. I mean, I don't know, anything more to say on verses 6 to 9? You know, he describes her. Yeah, sorry. Yeah, go ahead.
I thought you were going to read it again.
No, well, I can guess. If you want. It's, yeah.
No. But,
okay.
No, that's all right. Yeah, no, the breasts are like it's clusters here. Now, of course, you know, here whenever we talk about the breasts here, you know, the purpose that God created with that is for the nourishment of children, right? For nursing infants, to nurse at their mother's breast. And so it serves as a source of nourishment for children. And here, you know, that's one of the reasons that he's rejoicing in it. Her breasts are like its clusters. There's nourishment there. And you know, this is again going to the idea of the church being the way that the church is nourished here is through the, you know, it says clusters of the vine. That's what I was trying to get to. Yeah. So that kind of returns to that earlier idea that we had with the navel as a rounded bowl that never lacks mixed wine. Well, now we have breasts are like clusters of the vine, you know, that comparison to the nourishment that Christ gives us in the sacrament, I think can be made here as well.
Yeah, and the life-giving nature of what God has created in the mother's breast, that nurse, that was something we've talked about in other descriptions as well. Continued joy on the part of Solomon here for his bride. So he has described the great beauty of his love yet again, his bride, and she then returns to speak to him in the rest of our text for today. So we're picking up again here in the middle of 7 verse 9, and we're reading to the end of this cycle in 8 verse 4. So here's that text. It goes down smoothly for my beloved, gliding over lips and teeth. I am my beloved's, and his desire is for me. Come, my beloved, let us go out into the fields and lodge in the villages. Let us go out early to the vineyards and see whether the vines have budded, whether the grape blossoms have opened, and the pomegranates are in bloom. There I will give you my love. The mandrakes give forth fragrance, and beside our doors are all choice fruits, new as well as old, which I have laid up for you, O my beloved. Oh, that you were like a brother to me, who nursed at my mother's breasts. If I found you outside, I would kiss you, and none would despise me. I would lead you and bring you into the house of my mother, she who used to teach me. I would give you spiced wine to drink, the juice of my pomegranate. His left hand is under my head, and his right hand embraces me. I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, that you not stir up or awaken love until it pleases. And that takes us to the end of our text for today through chapter 8, verse 4 of the Song of Solomon. So she speaks to him, Pastor Vandercook. She says it goes down smoothly, gliding over lips and teeth. I am my beloved's and his desire is for me. We've heard that refrain, I am my beloved's, before, although she usually says my beloved is mine. Here that's slightly different. Talk to us about her first words to him in this section.
Yeah, it's almost, well, the second half of chapter, or not chapter, verse 9 again, chapter 7, verse 9. It's almost as if she's completing the sentence of her husband here, or completing the thought here, which, you know, I think those who are married can kind of relate to that. When you've been married for a while, especially, you get to the point where you do almost have that, where you tend to have a, you know how your spouse thinks, and so you're able to sort of complete his or her sentence, you know, or his or her thought. And that's almost kind of what you have happening here, you know, leading your mouth like the best wine. Oh yeah, that wine goes down smoothly for my beloved, gliding over lips and teeth. So you have that kind of completion of Solomon's thought there by her. Now that in verse 10, I was looking to verify this because I was, you know, but inside my wedding ring are the, my wife, before we got married, had this engraved on there, SS710. And so I thought that whenever I read it, I was like, I think that's the one that was engraved inside. I never know it's inside my wedding ring because it's always on my finger, you know?
Right.
But I looked just to verify that, and I was like, yep, that's the one. So it's a beautiful verse, you know, to have the response here of the Shulamite, I am my beloved, I belong to him, his desire is for me, which again points back to the stuff we were just talking about with the relationship that a husband has with his wife, that he is forsaking all others and uniting himself to her. And in this case, forsaking all others and rededicating himself to her is a nice reminder here in verse 10. Yeah.
Well, your name is even in that verse in the Hebrew.
It is, and that's
actually, is David. Yeah.
Yeah, we had that conversation. Laura and I talked about that, I remember, because I was like, oh, that's really neat. And the way that came up is we were looking at the James Avery Jewelry Company had these wedding bands that were replicas of the ring that Luther gave to his wife. And I think made for himself too. I'm not sure if I remember those details right. But anyway, I remember looking at those online and I was like, oh, that's my name in Hebrew, you know? So
that's
so anyway, yeah, that was the reasoning there.
That's so great. That's fantastic. Yeah. That's awesome. Yeah. So she continues to speak to her husband in verse 11, calling to him. I mean, she, you know, he has praised her beauty, and now she invites, you know, come, let's go into the fields, to the vineyards. Here we have more a garden imagery, like we talked about earlier. What else do you see as she invites him forth, starting there in verse 11?
Yeah, you almost get the picture of a married couple that says, hey, let's go for a walk, you know, let's go out and see what this looks like. Or even on a grander scale, let's go on a vacation, you know, let's go see the beauty of God's creation together. And it's kind of this just desire to be together as a, you know, the wife desires to be with her husband. She wants to spend some time with him and behold the beauty of God's creation. But of course, the, you know, it's leading up to eventually the, you know, the end of verse 12, there I will give you my love, that there is again this reconsummation of the marriage relationship that happens there. But, you know, there is a sort of courtship within the marriage, you know, maybe going out on a date as a married couple there that is kind of illustrated in chapter 11, or not chapter, I keep saying chapter, verse 11 and then most of verse 12.
Now, the mention of mandrakes in verse 13, I don't know if this is the same Hebrew word, but when I think about mandrakes, isn't, and I forget exactly where it is in the book of Genesis, where Leah and Rachel like exchange the relationships for, like, I forget whose night it was supposed to be with Jacob, the husband. And I think like Rachel sells her night with Leah for mandrakes, for some of her husband's mandrakes. The only reason I bring that up is because I think in the Song of Solomon, if that's maybe a point of contrast, here you have the glory of a monogamous union, one husband, one wife. Whereas, you know, in Jacob's life, when he's got those multiple women, that while God blesses him and gives him 12 sons, the relationship between him and those women often provides great heartache for him.
Yeah.
That's there or not. But when I hear mandrakes, I think of that story.
Yeah. Well, and yeah, I had to look up because I can never remember what a mandrake even is. And so I looked that up yesterday when I was preparing for today, and I was like, what is a mandrake? And mandrakes have this, they can be toxic actually, but they are used perhaps as an aphrodisiac type thing here as well, but they are fragrant, you know, so there's a lot of different things happening there. Apparently, I think it's the roots of the mandrakes that are actually toxic. So, I mean, I don't know if they're talking about the roots here, probably not. That seems to be out of place. But, you know, you have the idea here that they are an aromatic thing and, you know, so, and perhaps a thing that aids in, in fact, I think actually the note in the Lutheran Study Bible, yeah, I see it right there, actually does refer us back to Genesis 30, so I mean,
that's the text I was thinking about.
Yeah. So you're thinking of that same thing. And so, yeah, I mean, there is a lot of strife there that comes as a result of that. I don't think we necessarily want to see strife here at all.
No, I think it's the opposite here. Right? Yes, this is the good use of the mandrakes, if you will.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And so, and maybe it's worth just kind of mentioning here too, is that, you know, we look at the marriage relationship, you know, mandrakes being an aid to conception, the marriage relationship is designed to, it doesn't mean it always will, because, you know, sadly there are some that are unable to bear children, but it is designed to bring forth children. That is the, you know, the intended fruit of the marriage relationship as God designed it. And so, you know, that's in view here as well. We don't want to just simply look at this, the entire book of Song of Solomon, and see it just as erotic love, obviously. But, you know, the result of the love between a husband and a wife, the intended desired result is the conception and raising of children.
Yeah, no, I think that's good. And again, yeah, the mention of the mandrakes here, I don't think means strife at all, but the comparison perhaps to Genesis 30 maybe is an invitation to think about the good gift of the one husband, one wife, for till death parts them, the goodness of that monogamous relationship. You know, I mean, that's one thing that's been present here in the Song of Solomon, maybe not always spoken, but that this is, you know, Solomon and his one wife, and any, you know, all the stuff that happens later in Solomon's reign is kind of out of the picture. This is a good gift of God. The picture of marriage is a man and a woman who unite themselves to each other and forsake all others. And I think, you know, we've seen that throughout the book. We're continuing to see that here.
Yeah, kind of ironic when you think about the fact of how many wives Solomon ends up with.
Yeah.
But at the same time, the picture here, I agree with you, the picture here is very much, this is the one woman for me. Yeah.
Yep. Yep. And as you said, then for the purpose of bearing children, that is among the gifts of God given in marriage, and Solomon and his bride are rejoicing in that here. As we move into the part of chapter 8, she says something that maybe strikes us as a little unusual, where she says, "Oh, that you were like a brother to me." And we talked about this on the other side of it when Solomon spoke about his bride, his sister, and we noted that this isn't any sort of incestuous thing, but rather a matter of closeness, that these two as husband and wife are, you know, they're one flesh. They're as close as family. And I would imagine that's what's going on here with her saying like a brother.
Yeah. You know, when you look at the culture of that day, and perhaps there's something to be learned here for us as well, the type of romantic relationship, the relationship that a husband and a wife have, is not designed to be something that is necessarily broadcast in front of the whole world, you know. And so it would not be, in particular at that day and time, it would not be common for a husband and wife really to display their affection for one another at all in the eyes of the public. But the woman wants to be able to do that. That type of display, that type of closeness, would only be expressed within the confines of a family, you know. And so that type of affection, the type of affection that a brother and sister have for one another, that was acceptable to be seen in the public. And now she's desiring that type of closeness, and she would like to be able to have that display of affection even on the outside, you know, that she could kiss him in public and none would despise her for it, you know, whereas that would not necessarily be seen as something acceptable in that day for the wife to kiss her husband in public even. I mean, we do that all the time now, I think, and nobody really thinks anything of it. But of course, the culture dictated something a little bit different in those days.
Hmm. As the text draws to a conclusion in verses 3 and 4, we hear words that are very familiar from other places. The matter of both the husband's left hand and right hand, the fullness of his love. We talked about that image before. And then we have this adjuring of the daughters of Jerusalem not to stir up or awaken love until it pleases. We've heard that a couple of times previously in the book. Now we've got about 2 minutes here to wrap things up, Pastor Vandercook. But those verses and help us again to see Christ and the love of his love for his church here in this section.
There's an expression almost of kind of gentleness, in verse 3 there, just that the care and love that he has for his bride, gently cradling her. And, you know, again, it points to the reality again that Christ has for the church, the love and affection that he has for the church, gently embracing her. And verse 4, not sure how you've talked about it before, but this is kind of the way I looked at it, was that the daughters of Jerusalem, you know, there is a time for love, and that time comes at the time of that marriage relationship being established, that is whenever it is acceptable to have this love stirred up and not before then. So, you know, kind of a prohibition, I suppose, against this type of relationship before the marital union is established.
Yeah, that's right. We've mentioned before what's spoken in the marriage rite about not coming to marriage in lust, but rather with deliberation and with holiness. And I think a similar thing is happening there with verse 4. Again, we've been seeing the love that God gives to a husband and wife in this section and the love that Christ has for his church. Pastor David Vandercook serves at Bethlehem Evangelical Lutheran Church in Crawford, Nebraska, and Redeemer Evangelical Lutheran Church in Harrison, Nebraska. He's been helping us today to study Song of Solomon, chapter 6, verse 11 through chapter 8, verse 4. Pastor Vandercook, thanks for being our guest today.
Well, thanks for having me again.
I'm your host here on Sharper Iron, Pastor Timothy Apple of Faith Lutheran Church in Godfrey, Illinois. If you have any questions about this section of Song of Solomon, send an email to kfuo@kfuo.org. It is always a joy to hear from you. Join us again tomorrow as we conclude the Song of Solomon with the rest of chapter 8, and then the rest of the week we'll take a look at some more texts from the scriptures that help us to understand and rejoice in God's gift of marriage. Thanks for spending the morning with us today. Talk with you again tomorrow.
Showing support for KFUO is now easier than ever. You can sport a KFUO shirt, swag, or even socks by visiting our online store. Go to kfuo.org/store and order high-quality KFUO-branded merch. You no longer need to wait for our annual share-a-thon for a chance to show your KFUO spirit. Visually share and wear this ministry out in the world by checking out our selection. Every purchase helps to support our proclamation of Christ for you, anytime, anywhere. Go to kfuo.org/store.